Hello, here we are. It's Kenneth Nichols with the Great Writers Steel podcast. Today, we are going to talk to George Williams, a very cool author, the writer of the book The Valley of Happiness from Raw Dog Screaming Books. Many thanks to Jennifer Barnes for hooking up this interview. We're going to talk about quotation marks, when they are and are not necessary. We're going to talk about bookstores and how a tangible, physical book can mean a lot to you. We're going to talk about Back to the Future very briefly. The point is that Mr. Williams has given us a very interesting interview, talked about a lot of subjects, and you're going to want to hear this. It's all coming up right after this. Hello, we are here with George Williams, author of The Valley of Happiness, a new collection out from Raw Dog Screaming Press. Hello, Mr. Williams.
Good afternoon. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. In case you're listening to this on a different day, it is January 1st, 2015. Can you believe we are in the year that Back to the Future 2 was set in?
I just heard about that on the radio. I'd completely forgotten.
Isn't it crazy? We're further away from 1985 than Marty McFly was from 1955. But yeah, we are here to talk about your book. If you wouldn't mind, tell us a little about yourself. You're down there in the beautiful and snow-free South.
Yes, I live in Savannah, Georgia, and I teach at Savannah College of Art and Design in the creative writing minor and / major. So I teach almost entirely fiction workshops. And when I first came to an art school, I didn't know what to expect, because you think visual, artists, might not, have some facility with, but I've been really truly surprised. In the 15 years I've been here, I've had students that could have gone on to publish books if they stuck with it, but they're doing computer animation or sequential art.
Well, I guess I'm curious then, what do you feel is the relationship between visual art and the written word?
Well, and gosh, that's a tough question.
You can take a little bit of it, just a little part.
I'll just put it this way. They are a hell of a lot better writers than I am a drawer. I can't even do hangman. So that's why I'm so impressed. But you'll notice the book covers. I mean, I took a lot of art history as an undergraduate. So and Raw Dog Screaming is nice enough to let me choose the book covers. So that's, the influence visual art has on my writing, like Gardens of Earthly Delight, which is clearly, stolen from Bosch.
I'm definitely interested to ask about that. I don't have a copy of the Gardens of Earthly Delight on my desk, but it was prominently featured a painting, I forget by whom, you mentioned.
Hieronymus Bosch.
Yeah, and this one, Peter Bruegel the Elder, a beautiful picture, a painting, The Magpie on the Gallows, beautiful and also somewhat sad.
Yes, it is a sort of trick of the eye that when you first look at it, it looks like someone's being dragged to the gallows, and then if you look at it more closely, you realize that they're dancing. The gallows is grim enough, but then, of course, it turns out no one's going to be hanged on that day. They're actually dancing, but it does. So I think I like that. It's sort of that ambivalence to me sort of fit some of the stuff I was trying to do in the book. So, and the great thing about that, you can go onto Art Store and download these images. They're not copyrighted because no one,
It's 500 years old. What are they going to do?
Yes, exactly. I tried to buy an image from a contemporary artist and for a novel on another press, and decided on another image. But he was pretty reasonable. I got him down to $250.
Well, that's not bad at all. And I was reminded with the cover of The Valley of Happiness of the Fall of Icarus.
Oh, yes, right, yes, exactly.
It's an image that, that you know, under immediate scrutiny seems to be somewhat just normal, happy, and then there's a really dark undertone.
Yes, and Auden, of course, used that beautifully in that poem.
Oh, definitely. And I want to draw the connection then between these kind of mixed tone images, paintings, and the book. The book is filled with a number of stories that indeed look at people. There's sad situations, but there's also a kind of sheen of normalcy on it. Would you talk about the tone that you were thinking about as the book came together?
Well, because some of those stories are fairly new and others are old, I didn't really have a sort of consistent tone in mind. The difference, you know, a novel is obviously you're able to make a lot more mistakes and maybe get away with a lot more, I suppose. But every story for me is just an experiment, and it starts to create its own rules as you write it, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with any other story that I've written. And Flannery O'Connor put that wonderfully, and I like to share that with my students. And, you know, the best thing to do when you're trying to write a story is just to sit down and write and see what you have, and then see what you can make out of it, rather than having some... Well, she herself used to believe that she thought she was retarded, and that was, I believe, her word, which is now sort of politically incorrect, because in her 20s she thought that, you know, sitting down and just writing a line and a paragraph and another paragraph and sort of feeling your way along, not having any idea what the story is even about, she thought that was completely the wrong approach. She thought the writer sat down and knew exactly what the story was and sort of just transcribed it from their mind. And I think most short story writers, I mean, the ones I admire the most, like Joy Williams, I mean, it takes her 3 months to write a story. And, I'm sure she, you know, doesn't write just one at a time. But I imagine her approach is probably the same. So that, so there's no, in my mind, there's no conscious tone that's established by any given collection. And in this case, I gave the title, I drew the title from the title of one of the stories, which I actually stole from Samuel Johnson, Rassilis, I believe. So we're using, you know, I'm talking to the blogger of Great Writers Steal, and I keep talking about what I'm stealing, you know, art and titles and everything else.
Well, that's what we all do. We take... little things and we make them our own. And in the way that you mentioned, I'm currently working on another young adult novel, and you know, so whenever you start a big project or any project, you do have to figure out the rules of your own specific work and what they want to be. And if I can examine that idea in with a specific story, for example, I really liked Slave for a Day from the collection. I like them all, but Slave for a Day seemed like it required you to make up your own rules as you went along.
Mm-hmm.
The story starts, my name was N. Boy John in the first person. The project was part of the Federal Reparations Act of 20 and then 2 underscores. I was assigned a family and given an address. You're depicting a kind of reverse race slavery situation. How did you decide upon how the work would progress, and how did you fill in your own rules for it?
I don't know. The title. I started with the title because I was talking to someone about this question of reparations, which was coming up. It's been sort of back on the table now, and he joked, "Well, in addition to this, they could, you know, we could be a slave for a day." And I thought, well, that would be a hilarious way to satirize, you know, bureaucracy. And so, you know, I invented this in my mind, invented this program where, you know, you're assigned to go spend a day. In this case, he's sent to this suburb outside Atlanta, which I researched, which is, and I've seen about it on television, of extraordinarily well-to-do African Americans in Atlanta who are like CEOs of corporations, and they were asked, well, this is strange. This neighborhood is, you know, everyone's wealthy, they're building these beautiful houses, and it's all black. And they said, well, you know, anybody can live here. It's just the way it turned out. And so, you know, I think it would be ironic that he would wind up this. He's not even an American national. Right. So he's assigned to go to this wealthy family's home. And then he decides, well, he's just not going to leave because he has nowhere to go. So, anyway, I don't want, you know, that's just a general outline of the story, but he eventually does leave, you know.
Well, what I found.
I just had a lot of fun with it. And it was also this notion of, partly a modern, you know, liberal and libertarian, but a part of me is a bit of a medieval Catholic. So there's a great deal of crucifixion going on in there, which is sort of part of the comic element.
Yeah, definitely. I love that you've kind of you've stolen that idea that you got in conversation. This happened so many times. And in some ways, especially toward the beginning, I think that you just kind of reversed the reality of it. Invoking lynching, but reversing it to be a Barbie doll instead of, and you know, an African American reference, and then as the story builds, it becomes something of its own as opposed to just a reversal of these references.
Right.
Okay, so we can definitely learn that for our own work. We can alter the reality and flip it literally, but then we have to make it something our own. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry, just trying to take something, sort of turn it upside down, inside out, and you know, see if it works. And believe me, I've had plenty of stories where, with that in mind, they didn't work. They sort of just didn't go anywhere. But you know, it's not just the notion of doubling, which is a pretty common motif in fiction. But anyway, any other stories you had? Questions about, or?
Oh, don't worry. I have plenty of questions. In terms of the overall aesthetic, I was thinking of Bartholomew a lot. In terms of experimentation, in terms of violating the standard scene-making conventions, were you inspired by him, or how do you think of your stories as opposed to just, I guess I'm locked into, a lot of scene work, strong narrators instead of just immersing a reader.
Yes, well, I, in 1987, I moved to Houston. I was at University of Florida, and the writer Padgett Powell was there, and one night we were standing around his kitchen drinking. He said, you know, your best shot is to go to Houston and work with Don. I said, well, I don't know. So he got on the phone and called him, and then I was on the phone with the Donald Bartholomew, and I was like, and he said, are you coming? And I said, I don't know. And he said, afraid? I said, yes. So you know, I hung up and said, what the deuce? I've got nothing to lose. So I packed up and moved out there, and I was lucky enough to work with him for a few years. He was a really great presence and superb teacher and editor and I guess coach, as he's been called. And sadly, you know, he died young, at 58. I don't know if I'm consciously influenced by him. I mean, I certainly wouldn't compare my work to his. I mean, I think he's, you know, Bartholomew is Bartholomew. There's just no one else like him. But I think some of those more experimental elements probably are half conscious or maybe unconscious influence of working with him and reading his work.
Yeah, I was reading his collection Amateurs a couple days ago, so they kind of, you know, it was prominent in my head. I'm really happy I asked about that. Do you think that you can begin with the kind of the kind of premise that he would begin with, or to a lesser extent that you begin with? For example, in Amateurs, there's a story that's told all in questions. How do you make the move between saying, okay, I'm going to write a story that's all in questions, and then make it into something that, you know, in lesser hands like mine, it would be awful. How do you make it good?
I don't know. You'll have to ask him that. I mean, that's how can you make, like the Glass Mountain, where the guy's climbing a skyscraper with plungers. You can't read a page of his writing without laughing. I mean, there's just something uncanny about his sense of humor and his timing. And there are less experimental stories like the School. I don't know if you know that. And then there's some that I think are, to me almost indecipherable. So there's a wide range of things he's doing there. And of course the novels, from Snow White through his last, The King, are all quite different. And so it seemed like perhaps I picked up for him that idea, try and do something new every time you sit down and do a story, not tell the same story over and over again.
Yeah, I like the way that you put that, because you managed to do that with all the stories in the book. There's a kind of nugget of strangeness, but you're not just showing off and not just, you know, saying, hey, check it out, I wrote a weird story. It seems like you're really interested in narrative. For example, in the story Beastings, it's about a young woman who happens to lactate a lot. So I'm guessing you started out with that kind of germ of an idea, and then made it into something more important.
Well, that started with a I was married for a time, and I used this in another story in that collection, and my wife was breastfeeding, and she was, my daughter was breastfeeding, or her mother was breastfeeding our daughter, and, the pressure would just build up, and she would have to, use a pump and drain it. And one time she was doing that, she looked up, she goes, "Now I get it." And so I said, "Get what?" "You men, men are always having to relieve the pressure." So it's, I just changed the glands. Instead of testes, I just said mammary. So, and then she ends up, that's a sort of comic apocalyptic story. But by the end of the stories, things will be regenerated. That's the notion. But she's considered this freak because she starts lactating before she's even hit puberty. And, which is not really that strange now, because, they're reporting puberty in women now as early as 4 and 5 years old.
What?
They don't know what the explanation for this is. So that's not as, obviously she's not pregnant, so that, that's sort of bizarre and unscientific fact of the story, or pseudo fact. But that's sort of where the idea for that story came from. And I just kept going to it and adding scenes. And, she would go from one relationship to another, and they all ended in some sort of bad way.
I think a similar dynamic is at work in the story Moon, which is in strict terms, it's science fiction, but I guess it would be more literary, for whatever that means, whatever these distinctions mean. Again, you start out with an idea, with a central idea, and then kind of take off with it. What do you think is your philosophy in terms of casting scenes in present tense or in past tense, like doing actual scene work, and serving your central idea in other ways? How do you think about that?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure what the question is.
In a lot of the stories, the narrators are in very strong control, and we do often get it, but you often omit the kind of scene work that like a very strictly drawn scene. How do you get the narrator to fly along so fast? How do you decide what to look to overlook?
I guess, you know, the standard modes of realism, you know, that scene building and this, and I just, you know, having written novels that really were not particularly good, I thought, well, I'll just dispense with this and get to the sort of heart of the conflict or drama as soon as I can. And in the case of that story, I mean, that was sort of a send up of the hysteria about Star Wars back in the 80s. And, you know, so then you can imagine this world of these satellites with, you know, that have, lasers on them and one of them spinning out of control and boiling swimming pools and stuff like that. I just had a lot of fun with that. It's also a sort of, again, a send up of bureaucracy.
I noticed at the end of the story, you point out that the fragments that are falling through the atmosphere hit the poet laureate.
Yes.
You're tying the kind of literary to the military industrial complex on that. I thought that was funny. The main thing that I wanted to talk about, because like I said before our interview, it's a big thing for me, and I'm always curious about it. The quotation marks, they are omitted in the stories. And obviously this is a choice that many, many writers make. The quotation marks, they serve a purpose, and they have an effect on the reader, but omitting them does the same thing. Could you talk about the reasons that you omit the quotation marks in your dialogue?
Yes, I like the way it looks, and I mean, I've been advised against it, but it gives a kind of muted quality or even spectral quality to the dialogue. And once I stopped using them, I really didn't miss them. And when I read writers who don't use them, it doesn't bother me. And I've had people say they can't stand to read fiction without quotation marks, et cetera. But again, as long as it's clear to the reader who's saying what to whom and when and why, then you can use any kind of punctuation you want. I mean, some people use dashes. I know some writers in one book they'll use dashes, another one they'll use quotation marks, and another book they'll just drop all the quotation marks. So I mean, these are just conventions. They're not axioms of any kind in writing fiction. So, and it's just, I just like the way they look.
Oh, definitely. That's fine.
The dialogue without quotation marks.
Yeah. I'll point out that in GOAT, you use italics to indicate dialogue. In addition to omitting the quotation marks. So how does omitting the quotation marks change the relationship between the narrator and the reader and the narrator and the characters?
Gosh. I hope that it doesn't change it at all. As long as it's clear who's speaking and when, and that it is dialogue, and I hope that it is clear. It may not, in some cases, it may not be, easy for me to see that. Well, this might not be clear enough for the reader. In the case of using those italics, I just thought it created a stranger. I mean, that's a very dark story. It's easily. Definitely the darkest story in there, and that was I had lived in Houston for 11 years, and there were so many abductions and disappearing women, and it wasn't like Juarez or anything, but it was really spooky and kind of disturbing, and just trying to imagine who are these people or who is this person who is doing this. And it was based on the disappearance of a girl who was driving to Tiki Island and stopped on the side of the road on the way home. She left the restaurant, and I think she was 17, and that was the last anybody saw of her. And witnesses saw her on the side of the road, and a truck stopped behind her, like she had had car trouble, and then she was never seen of again. This was 1997. It was just one of those things that, it got a lot of press. And it was kind of just all around disturbing, you know, what happened to her, no one knows, and probably no one ever will know. So I started sort of imagining, you know, just who this person was and, you know, what they were up to or how they did it. So kind of creeped me out to write it, frankly.
I've done that too. I've written a couple stories where, the subject matter, it had to go there, and it's part of the human experience, but it's not my, it wasn't my personal favorite thing to think about, but that's what we do.
Right, exactly.
I want to ask one question in specific about the quotation marks, and then I want to go back to your really you're really interesting in terms of coming up with ideas. For example, in the story, I'm just looking randomly at Ginny Shea on page 62. We have a quotation mark list, a bit of dialogue. The character says, "I will surprise you." New paragraph. Okay. No quotation marks. She wrote her address and phone number on a slip of paper she tore from a notebook, but call first. My boyfriend won't exactly understand. I think that, like, obviously it's not a criticism. Does it require a little bit more of a reader to know who is saying okay and who's speaking at that moment?
I think it does make the reader perhaps slow down a bit and maybe pay more attention. But as a reader, I don't mind doing that myself, so I don't feel like I'm, you know, asking too much of a reader to do that for what I write. So, I might not be clear enough. Yeah, that's that was a fun story to write. It was inspired by the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, who spent a year in Colorado, and he wrote, it was hilarious. If you read what he wrote about his experiences, and I think it was in the late 40s or early 50s, about the decadence of Americans, and who by today's standards were, you know, goodness. And he was absolutely horrified at the, you know, and those phrases that character uses, there's phrases I took right out of his writing, translated them, you know, into English, referring to these women as being, you know, tempting animals and stuff like that, and, you know, lascivious, and I'm forgetting all the words, but, when I read that, I was laughing out loud. I said, how on earth can anybody be that shocked by his, you know, a dance at a college? Well, I mean, he was a bit of a religious fanatic, and, you know, his fate was unfortunate. I mean, he went back to Egypt and was persecuted by the government, eventually jailed, he created the Muslim Brotherhood, whose descendants now are among us still, from Al-Qaeda to ISIS, etc. So I just felt like that was worth satirizing, frankly.
Very cool. I think that not only are we going to, which I think we've all done, and I've definitely done, steal people's, like, old-timey words from them, but I love that I'm coming to more peace with omitting the quotation marks, because it reminds me of the lineation that we do in poetry. We're deliberately slowing the reader down in order to have an effect to control how they consume the narrative, or in that case, the lines of poetry.
Yes, I hadn't thought of it that way. I like that.
Yeah, no, I like that too. Because I'm just trying to understand it. You know, that's how I approach things. I have to talk about it because you keep saying really interesting things. A lot of people have trouble coming up with ideas, you know, and some of us, you know, more than others. But it seems like you're really good at picking up on hearing an idea and saying, "Hey, I wonder what would happen if." Where can we find these ideas? Or how do you know when you've come up with something good?
Oh, it's only when I, you know, start writing it, and if it starts going places, and, you know, you get in that, or as a writer I work with said, you know, it's it's not, I don't have writer's block. It's like, you know, some days I can only write a few sentences. Other days I can write all day. So if the idea of, if the story feels like it's working and, you know, you stop and you know where it's going to go the next day, I mean, that's the happiest place in the world to be when you're writing fiction. I mean, and it takes sometimes a lot of work to get there, and that's, you know, part of the frustration of it. Believe me, I've had plenty of ideas that went just nowhere. I've got folders of ideas of, you know, things that just never, you know, I thought they seemed really promising, and then they just, you know, they just sort of died in the on the first page.
Those are definitely good ideas for people. I whenever people tell me, oh, I don't know what to write about, you know, there are 8 billion news stories out there. There are, you know, you pick up any kind of book, any kind of article, and you have the potential to say, wow, that's really interesting. I wonder what would happen if, or, you know, there, if you are reading enough, something is going to be tripped up in your head. And I also love the idea that, as I'm working on my young adult novel now, you write and kind of stop where you know you're going to pick up the next day, and then you can just kind of slide back into where you were.
Yes, and that's I think that's some advice Hemingway gave in his Paris Review interview that I'm always stuck with me, and probably thousands of others. And it does mostly work. Donald Bartholomew told me, I'm sure he told others, you know, write about what you fear most. And that was, you know, the sort of inspiration, if you will, behind the first and only novel I published. Because, you know, what does any father fear most is any harm coming to a child. So it's really about, that's the, sort of the subject of the novel. The other thing is, you know, you hear this sort of commonly, write about what you know, and that gets criticized a lot. But I think when I hear people object to that, well, that just means write about yourself or your own personal experience. It's really, that's not the case, because what you can imagine is what you know. That's a form of knowledge. And I love to use the example of Shakespeare. You know, he couldn't have possibly written these plays because he was, you know, he had the fifth grade education, you know, whatever. Well, the kind of education he had, you know, he would have been smarter in Latin and rhetoric than a Harvard graduate today. The other thing is, he went to London and surrounded himself by intelligent people. I'm sure, you know, this is the idea. This is not original with me. It's a wonderful book about this controversy about who wrote his plays, whose title I can't recall right now. But and so he surrounds himself with ambitious, smart, intelligent people. You know, he's borrowing books. He's hearing stories of their travels. And it really underestimates the power of the imagination. Say that because he didn't go to, you know, Venice, he couldn't possibly have written a play about that city. I think that's just absurd. It completely underestimates the power of the imagination. So when I ask my students to write about what they know, I emphasize that, you know, write about what you heard, write about what you, you know, things you've read, things you, you know, imagined, dreamt, whatever. And, you know, from all that range of things, you know, you're not writing about yourself. And I don't really write autobiographical fiction, although that is very much the trend now. Many writers are saying that they feel like that the conventions of realistic or realist fiction are feel so false to them that they feel like that now that they have to write autobiographical fiction. And I imagine in some cases it works, in others it may not. I'm not familiar with a lot of these writers. But that, I've noticed that trend in the last few years. And, of course, memoirs are do better than fiction. And I have no idea why. But that's, again, another trend. On a slightly less happy note, I recently read a book about the publishing world, and one of the most powerful agents, Lynn Nesbitt, said, you know, if literary fiction is not dying, if it's not dead already, it is dying. And that was a, you know, pretty grim prognostication. But then again, she said, you know, the memoirs are what are selling, even if they are made up, you know, like the famous cases of. Yes, go ahead.
I love that you're a Stratfordian, by the way, as am I. But also, what is it? These terms always, I always wonder about them. What do you think it means to be literary? What do you think makes a literary novel or a short story collection literary?
I just suppose as a genre in general, and as a publishing genre, I guess in literary fiction the expectations of the quality of the use of language is much higher, and that's fine. I mean, when people read other genres, they don't, especially, I mean, my goodness, Dan, people who read Dan Brown don't expect and don't care. And, he's been called the worst, most successful writer in history. So, that works. But I guess because my training, my early interest was in, I guess like most all fiction writers, I'm a failed poet.
I'm just torn because to a great extent I totally agree with you. The only book I kind of go negative on my site is Twilight. And if you opened up the book randomly to any page, you'll just cry because the writing is so bad. But people buy it. But on the other hand, I don't have much of a problem with people reading Harry Potter or a ton of other stuff that it's really, really fun. And how do you classify literary and I guess just commercial fiction? Like T.C. Boyle, I find to be very, I love him and his stories are great and his language is beautiful, but I can also see anybody picking up one of his books and enjoying them. So I always wonder what people mean when they say literary, not in a bad way, just what is that line and what does it mean?
Well, I think it's becoming harder to define. I mean, there are lots of writers out there who are, mixing up genres and doing, speculative fiction. I mean, a writer that has been recommended to me, who just recently published The Bone Clocks, Jim Mitchell, apparently is doing this quite well, and so it's what do you call his fiction? I mean, it's hugely popular, it's literary, it's brilliant by all reports, and so I don't know. I guess the old categories are sort of breaking down, and I guess you could say it's insane. Art is hard to define, but you know it when you see it. So it's just really, I guess, probably more of a question about just good writing as opposed to mediocre writing.
Oh, definitely.
But,
and
publishing industry, literary fiction as a, it is, I guess, selling less and less. And
well, speaking of bookstores, I always think of Ray Bradbury and where do you put him? Because, his writing is beautiful and amazing and powerful. Do you put him in the literary? Do you put him in science fiction, which would also be fair? And that leads me to the subject of bookstores. We're writers. We're people of the written word. What are some of the bookstores that you love the most?
Well, in town there is the Book Lady, and she hosts readings and signings, and it's an independent used bookstore. They sell new books as well, and that's my favorite bookstore in town. Of course, we have the Barnes & Noble at the mall. In New York, 192 Books is really there's something old school about their standards they just want the absolute best sort of writing out there. And I don't know if you've ever been, but if you're in New York, you should stop by there.
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't been to that one. I've been to the Strand. I've been to a bunch of other bookstores in New York. And again, I agree. I have my own ideas, but what is the reason that we need to continue to have independent bookstores?
Well, I think I can't rehearse this argument against what Amazon is doing to the publishing industry, but I guess the danger is between Amazon and these Barnes and Noble, there's, what matters is what sells the most, and that would tend to sort of weed out, I guess, writers, maybe, if you don't sell X number of hundreds of thousands of copies. Or, a writer I know, his first novels sold 20 or 30,000 copies, which, a generation or two ago would have been like, okay, but, you get a 3 or 4 book deal, and, you would work with the publisher, and that would be, you would have sort of your career with this publisher, and then they dropped him because that wasn't enough. But as first novels go, that was really pretty good. So, again, I don't understand exactly how all this is going to play out. Of course, no one does. But I think independent bookstores are great because you find stuff in there that you just wouldn't find anywhere else. Whether they're old, used books, or, and they tend to be more eclectic and a bit more eccentric in their taste than something like a Barnes and Noble.
That's one of the things that I find really valuable too. The other day I got a book from 1961 about gambling, and it's written in this beautifully kind of Goodfellas-y prose about how you take the vig and how the bets are made and how you can win at roulette. It's just this really cool book that I would not have found otherwise.
And you found that in a used bookstore?
Right. And you pay a lot less, you pay a really low price and no shipping. It's just you do experience things that you wouldn't otherwise experience. You can give a chance to something for $3.99 as opposed to, an $18 trade paperback, definitely.
Another thing I might recommend for people who live in cities like Houston every year, or they used to, but they may not still, the library would have a huge book sale at the, like at the Civic Center. And if you went there the first couple of days, you could get, I remember walking out of there with boxes and boxes of, books that were not even, they didn't have call numbers written on them. And, they just have to clear out their inventory to make room for more books. And that's, for people who love books, that is a great way to get books for nothing. And then the last few days, you could go in there with a grocery bag, and they would charge you by the, $5 a bag, and you would just fit in there anything you thought would be interesting.
No, I love doing that. It's such a good feeling. You pick up, it's so cool. I've done that on several occasions where I get, a big stack of virtually free books. And, you get some awesome stuff. Joyce Carol Oates I got the other day. These are things that we need to preserve.
Yes. I read, digitally. My brother gave me a Kindle, and, I have a lot of stuff on there that you can get through Gutenberg.org for nothing. A writer was in town, a humorist, and he was giving a talk to a class that I was visiting. And someone asked him about, what do you think about digital books? And he says, well, if anyone ever shows me my book is on their Kindle, I'll be happy to sign the screen for them. Which I thought was hilarious. In other words, he didn't like them at all. And I don't know. They're here, and I don't think they're going to replace the physical book. I just don't think, they thought digital recording would get rid of analog and albums. And albums, I'm not a you know, I'm a great music person, but I understand albums have made a bit of a comeback.
I love the Nook. I have a Nook because I don't want to do the Amazon thing at this point. But they I'm a baseball guy, and I love reading books about the steroid era, baseball history, and they're books that I might not necessarily need to have in paperback or hardcover. I don't want to make notes in them as much. So I love that I have all these books in one central place. But when I read, you know, The Valley of Happiness by George Williams, I want to hold it. I want to write in the margins. I want to have a closer relationship with the book.
Yes, there is something, I don't know, it's an experience that I just don't get digitally. And I think it's irreplaceable. I mean, to immerse yourself in a book for 3 or 4 hours at a time,
hello, here we are. It's Kenneth Nichols with the Great Writer's Steel podcast. Today, we are going to talk to George Williams, a very cool author, the writer of the book The Valley of Happiness from Raw Dog Screaming Books. Many thanks to Jennifer Barnes for hooking up this interview. We're going to talk about quotation marks, when they are and are not necessary. We're going to talk about bookstores, and how a tangible, physical book can mean a lot to you. We're going to talk about Back to the Future very briefly. The point is that Mr. Williams has given us a very interesting interview, talked about a lot of subjects, and you're going to want to hear this. It's all coming up right after this. Hello, we are here with George Williams, author of The Valley of Happiness, a new collection out from Raw Dog Screaming Press. Hello, Mr. Williams.
Good afternoon. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too, in case you're listening to this on a different day. It is January 1st, 2015. Can you believe we are in the year that Back to the Future 2 was set in?
I just heard about that on the radio. I'd completely forgotten.
Isn't it crazy? We're further away from 1985 than Marty McFly was from 1955. But yeah, we are here to talk about your book. If you wouldn't mind, tell us a little about yourself. You're down there in the beautiful and snow-free South.
Yes, I live in Savannah, Georgia. And I teach at Savannah College of Art and Design in the creative writing minor and / major. So I teach almost entirely fiction workshops. And when I first came to an art school, I didn't know what to expect, you know, because you think visual, you know, artists, you know, might not, you know, have some facility with, but I've been really truly surprised in the 15 years I've been here. I've had students that could have gone on to publish books if they stuck with it, but they, you know, they're doing computer animation or sequential art.
Well, I guess I'm curious then, what do you feel is the relationship between visual art and the written word?
Well, and gosh, that's a tough question.
Take a little bit of it, just a little part.
I'll just put it this way: they are hell of a lot better writers. I am a drawer. I can't even do hangman, so that's why I'm so impressed. But you'll notice the book covers. I mean, I took a lot of art history as an undergraduate, so and Raw Dog Screaming is nice enough to let me choose the book covers. So that's, you know, the influence visual art has on my writing, like Gardens of Earthly Delight, which is clearly, you know, stolen from Bosch.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely interested to ask about that. I don't have a copy of the Gardens of Earthly Delight on my desk, but it did have it. It was prominently featured a painting. I forget by whom you mentioned.
Hieronymus Bosch.
Yeah, and this one, Peter Bruegel the Elder, a beautiful picture, a painting, The Magpie on the Gallows, beautiful and also somewhat sad.
Yes, it's a sort of trick of the eye in that when you first look at it, it looks like someone's being dragged to the gallows. And then if you look at it more closely, you realize that they're dancing. So, you know, the gallows is grim enough, but then, of course, it turns out no one's going to be hanged on that day. They're actually dancing. But it does. So I think I like that. It's sort of that ambivalence to me sort of fit some of the stuff I was trying to do in the book. So, and the great thing about that, you can go onto Art Store and download these images. They're not copyrighted. Because no one, you know.
It's 500 years old. What are they going to do?
Yes, exactly. I tried to buy an image from a contemporary artist and for a novel on another press, and decided on another image. But he was pretty reasonable. I got him down to $250.
Well, that's not bad at all. And I was reminded with the cover of The Valley of Happiness of the Fall of Icarus.
Oh yes, right. Yes, exactly.
It's an image that that you know under immediate scrutiny seems to be somewhat just normal, happy, and then there's a really dark undertone.
Yes, and Auden, of course, used that beautifully in that poem.
Oh, definitely. And I want to draw the connection then between these kind of mixed tone images, paintings, and the book. The book is filled with a number of stories that indeed look at people. There's sad situations, but there's also a kind of sheen of normalcy on it. Would you talk about the tone that you were thinking about as the book came together?
Well, because some of those stories are fairly new and others are old, I didn't really have a sort of consistent tone in mind. The difference, you know, a novel is obviously you're able to make a lot more mistakes and maybe get away with a lot more, I suppose. But every story for me is just an experiment, and it starts to create its own rules as you write it, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with any other story that I've written. And Flannery O'Connor put that wonderfully, and I like to share that with my students. And, you know, the best thing to do when you want to write a story is just to sit down and write and see what you have and then see what you can make out of it, rather than having some... Well, she herself used to believe that she thought she was retarded, and that was, I believe, her word, which is now sort of politically incorrect, because in her 20s she thought that, you know, sitting down and just writing a line and a paragraph and another paragraph and sort of feeling your way along, not having any idea what the story is even about, she thought that was completely the wrong approach. She thought that writers sat down and knew exactly what the story was and sort of just transcribed it from their minds. And I think most short story writers, I mean, the ones I admire the most, like Joy Williams, I mean, it takes her 3 months to write a story. And I'm sure she, you know, doesn't write just one at a time, but I imagine her approach is probably the same. So that, so there's no, in my mind, there's no conscious tone that's established by any given collection. And in this case, I gave the title, I drew the title from the title of one of the stories, which I actually stole from Samuel Johnson, Rassilis, I believe. So we're using, you know, I'm talking to the blogger of Great Writers Steal, and I keep talking about what I'm stealing, you know, art and titles and everything else.
Well, that's what we all do. We take... little things and we make them our own. And in the way that you mentioned, I'm currently working on another young adult novel, and you know, so whenever you start a big project or any project, you do have to figure out the rules of your own specific work and what they want to be. And if I can examine that idea with a specific story, for example, I really liked Slave for a Day from the collection. I like them all, but Slave for a Day seemed like it required you to make up your own rules as you went along.
Mm-hmm.
The story starts, my name was N-Boy John in the first person. The project was part of the Federal Reparations Act of 20 and then two underscores. I was assigned a family and given an address. You're depicting a kind of reverse race slavery situation. How did you decide upon how the work would progress, and how did you fill in your own rules for it?
I don't know. I started with the title because I was talking to someone about this question of reparations, which was coming up. It's been sort of back on the table now. And he joked, well, in addition to this, we could be a slave for a day. And I thought that would be a hilarious way to satirize, bureaucracy. I invented this program where you're assigned to go spend the day. In this case, he's sent to this suburb outside Atlanta, which I did my research, which I've seen about it on television, of extraordinarily well-to-do African Americans in Atlanta who are like CEOs of corporations, and they were asked, well, this is strange. This neighborhood is, everyone's wealthy. They're building these beautiful houses, and it's all black. And they said, well, anybody can live here. It's just the way it turned out. And so, I think it would be ironic that he would wind up this. He's not even an American national. And right, so he's assigned to go to this wealthy family's home. And then he decides, well, he's just not going to leave because he has nowhere to go. So, I don't want, that's just a general outline of the story, but he eventually does leave,
Well, what I
just had a lot of fun with it. It was also this notion of, I'm partly a modern, liberal and libertarian, but a part of me is a bit of a medieval Catholic. So there's a great deal of crucifixion going on in there, which is sort of part of the comic element.
Yeah, definitely. I love that you've kind of you've stolen that idea that you got in conversation. This happened so many times. And in some ways, especially toward the beginning, I think that you just kind of reversed the reality of it. Invoking lynching, but reversing it to be a Barbie doll instead of an African-American reference. And then as the story builds, it becomes something of its own as opposed to just a reversal of these references.
Right.
Okay, so we can definitely learn that for our own work. We can alter the reality and flip it literally, but then we have to make it something our own. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just trying to take something, sort of turn it upside down, inside out, and see if it works. And believe me, I've had plenty of stories where, with that in mind, they didn't work. They sort of just didn't go anywhere. It's not just the notion of doubling, which is a pretty common motif in fiction. But any other stories you had questions about, or?
Don't worry. I have plenty of questions. In terms of the overall aesthetic, I was thinking of Bartholomew a lot. In terms of experimentation, in terms of violating the standard scene-making conventions, were you inspired by him, or how do you think of your stories as opposed to just, I guess I'm locked into a lot of scene work, strong narrators instead of just immersing a reader?
Yes, well, in 1987, I moved to Houston. I was at University of Florida, and the writer Padgett Powell was there. And one night we were standing around his kitchen drinking. He said, your best shot is to go to Houston and work with Don. I said, well, I don't know. And so he got on the phone and called him. And then I was on the phone with the Donald Bartholomew, and I was like, and he said, are you coming? And I said, I don't know. And he said, afraid? I said, yes. So I hung up and said, what the deuce? I've got nothing to lose. So I packed up and moved out there. And I was lucky enough to work with him for a few years. He was a really great presence and superb teacher and editor and, I guess, coach, as he's been called. And sadly, you know, he died young, at 58. I don't know if I'm consciously influenced by him. I mean, I certainly wouldn't compare my work to his. I mean, I think he's, you know, Bartholomew is Bartholomew. There's just no one else like him. But I think some of those more experimental elements probably are a half-conscious or maybe unconscious influence of working with him and reading his work.
Yeah, I was reading his collection, Amateurs, a couple days ago, so they kind of, you know, it was prominent in my head. I'm really happy I asked about that. Do you think that you can begin with the kind of the kind of premise that he would begin with, or to a lesser extent that you begin with? For example, in Amateurs, there's a story that's told all in questions. How do you make the move between saying, okay, I'm going to write a story that's all in questions, and then make it into something that, you know, in lesser hands like mine, it would be awful. How do you make it good?
I don't know. You'll have to ask him that. I mean, that's how can you make, like the Glass Mountain, where the guy's climbing a skyscraper with plungers? You can't read a page of his writing without laughing. I mean, there's just something uncanny about his sense of humor and his timing. And there are less experimental stories like the School. I don't know if you know that. And then there's some that I think are, to me almost indecipherable. So there's a wide range of things he's doing there. And then of course the novels, from Snow White through his last, The King, are all quite different. And so it seemed like perhaps I picked up for him that idea of trying to do something new every time you sit down and do a story and not tell the same story over and over again.
Yeah, I like the way that you put that, because you managed to do that with all the stories in the book. There's a kind of nugget of strangeness, but you're not just showing off and not just, you know, saying, hey, check it out, I wrote a weird story. It seems like you're really interested in narrative. For example, in the story Beastings, it's about a young woman who happens to lactate a lot. So I'm guessing you started out with that kind of germ of an idea, and then made it into something more important.
Well, that started with a. I was married for a time, and I used this in another story in that collection, and my wife was breastfeeding, and she was, my daughter was breastfeeding, or her mother was breastfeeding our daughter, and, the pressure would just build up, and she would have to, use a pump and drain it. And one time she was doing that, she looked up, she goes, now I get it. And so I said, get what? You men, men are always having to relieve the pressure. So it's, I just changed the glands. instead of testes, I just said mammary. So, and then she ends up, that's a sort of comic apocalyptic story. But by the end of the stories, things will be regenerated. That's the notion. But she's considered this freak because she starts lactating before she's even hit puberty. And, which is not really that strange now, because, they're reporting puberty in women now as early as 4 and 5 years old.
What?
They don't know what the explanation for this is. So that's not as, obviously she's not pregnant, so that, that's sort of bizarre and unscientific fact of the story, or pseudo fact. But, that's sort of where the idea for that story came from. And I just kept going to it and adding scenes. And, she would go from one relationship to another, and they all ended in some sort of bad way.
I think a similar dynamic is at work in the story Moon, which is a I guess it's in strict terms it's science fiction, but I guess it would be more literary for whatever that means, whatever these distinctions mean. Again, you start out with an idea, with a central idea, and then kind of take off with it. What do you think is the is your philosophy in terms of casting scenes in present tense or, you know, or in past tense, like doing actual scene work and serving your central idea in other ways? How do you think about that?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure what the question is.
In a lot of the stories, the narrators are in very strong control, and we don't often get, we do often get it, but you often omit the kind of scene work that we find, like a very strictly drawn scene. How do you get the narrator to fly along so fast? How do you decide what to look to overlook?
I guess, you know, the standard modes of realism, you know, that scene building and this, and I just, you know, having written novels that really were not particularly good, I thought, well, I'll just dispense with this and get to the sort of heart of the conflict or drama as soon as I can. And in the case of that story, I mean, that was sort of a send up of the hysteria about Star Wars back in the 80s. And, you know, so then you can imagine this world of these satellites with, you know, that have lasers on them and one of them spinning out of control and boiling swimming pools and stuff like that. I just had a lot of fun with that. It's also a sort of, again, a send up of bureaucracy.
I noticed at the end of the story, you point out that the fragments that are falling through the atmosphere hit the poet laureate.
Yes.
You're tying the kind of literary to the military industrial complex on that. I thought that was funny. The main thing that I wanted to talk about because like I said before our interview, it's a big thing for me and I'm always curious about it. The quotation marks, they are omitted in the stories. And obviously this is a choice that many writers make. The quotation marks, they serve a purpose and they have an effect on the reader, but omitting them does the same thing. Could you talk about the reasons that you omit the quotation marks in your dialogue?
Yes, I like the way it looks, and I mean I've been advised against it, but it gives a kind of muted quality or even spectral quality to the dialogue. And once I stopped using them, I really didn't miss them. And when I read writers who don't use them, it doesn't bother me. And I've had people say they can't stand to read fiction without quotation marks, etc. But again, as long as it's clear to the reader, who's saying what to whom and when and why, then you can use any kind of punctuation you want. I mean, some people use dashes. I know some writers in one book they'll use dashes, another ones they'll use quotation marks, and another book they'll just drop all the quotation marks. So I mean, these are just conventions. They're not, you know, axioms of any kind in writing fiction. So, and it's just, I just like the way they look.
Oh, definitely. That's fine.
The dialogue without quotation marks.
Yeah. I'll point out that in GOAT, you use italics to indicate dialogue. In addition to omitting the quotation marks. So how does omitting the quotation marks change the relationship between the narrator and the reader and the narrator and the characters?
Gosh. I hope that it doesn't change it at all. As long as it's clear who's speaking and when, and that it is dialogue. And I hope that it is clear. It may not, in some cases, it may not be, easy for me to see that, well, this might not be clear enough for the reader. In the case of using those italics, that I just I'll just start with Creator the Stranger. I mean, that's a very dark story. It's easily, definitely the darkest story in there. And that was, I had lived in Houston for 11 years, and it just, there were just so many abductions and disappearing women. And it wasn't like, you know, Juarez or anything, but it was really spooky and kind of disturbing. And just trying to imagine, who are these people, or who is this person who is doing this? And, you know, just, it was based on the disappearance of a girl who was driving to Tiki Island and stopped on the side of the road on the way home. She left the restaurant, and I think she was 17, and that was the last anybody saw of her. And witnesses saw her on the side of the road, and a truck stopped behind her, like she had had car trouble, and then she was never seen of again. This was 1997. It was just one of those things that, you know, it got a lot of press, and it was kind of just all around disturbing, you know, what happened to her. No one knows, and probably no one ever will know. So I started sort of imagining, you know, just who this person was and, you know, what they were up to or how they did it. So kind of creeped me out to write it, frankly.
I've done that too. I've written a couple stories where, the subject matter, it had to go there, and it's part of the human experience, but it's not my, it wasn't my personal favorite thing to think about, but that's what we do.
Right, exactly.
I want to ask one question in specific about the quotation marks, and then I want to go back to your really you're really interesting in terms of coming up with ideas. For example, in the story, I'm just looking randomly at Ginny Shea on page 62. We have a quotation mark list, a bit of dialogue. The character says, "I will surprise you." New paragraph. Okay. No quotation marks. She wrote her address and phone number on a slip of paper she tore from a notebook, but call first. My boyfriend won't exactly understand. I think that, like, obviously it's not a criticism. Does it require a little bit more of a reader to know who is saying okay and who's speaking at that moment?
Yeah, I think it does make the reader perhaps slow down a bit and maybe pay more attention. But as a reader, I don't mind doing that myself, so I don't feel like I'm, you know, asking too much of a reader to do that for what I write. So, you know, again, I might not be clear enough. Yeah, that's that was a fun story to write. It was inspired by the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, who spent a year in Colorado, and he wrote, it was hilarious. If you read what he wrote about his experiences, and I think it was in the late 40s or early 50s, about the decadence of Americans, and who by today's standards were, you know, goodness. And he was absolutely horrified at, you know, and those phrases that character uses, there's phrases I took right out of his writing, translated them, you know, into English, referring to these women as being, you know, tempting animals and stuff like that, and, you know, lascivious, and I'm forgetting all the words, but, when I read that, I was laughing out loud. I said, how on earth can anybody be that shocked by these, you know, a dance at a college? Well, I mean, he was a bit of a religious fanatic, and, you know, his fate was unfortunate. I mean, he went back to Egypt and was persecuted by the government and eventually jailed. And that, he created the Muslim Brotherhood, whose descendants now are among us still, from Al-Qaeda to ISIS, et cetera. So I just felt like that was worth satirizing, frankly.
Very cool. I think that not only are we going to, which I think we've all done, and I've definitely done, steal people's, like, old-timey words from them, But I love that I'm coming to more peace with omitting the quotation marks, because it reminds me of the lineation that we do in poetry. We're deliberately slowing the reader down in order to have an effect to control how they consume the narrative, or in that case, the lines of poetry.
Yes, I hadn't thought of it that way. I like that.
Yeah, no, I like that too. Because I'm just trying to understand it. You know, that's how I approach things. I have to talk about it because you keep saying really interesting things. A lot of people have trouble coming up with ideas, you know, and some of us, you know, more than others. But it seems like you're really good at picking up on hearing an idea and saying, hey, I wonder what would happen if. Where can we find these ideas? Or how do you know when you've come up with something good?
Oh, it's only when I, you know, start writing it, and if it starts going places and, you know, you get in that, writer I work with said, you know, I don't have writer's block. It's like, you know, some days I can only write a few sentences. Other days I can write all day. If the idea, if the story feels like it's working and, you know, you stop and you know where it's going to go the next day, I mean, that's the happiest place in the world to be, when you're writing fiction. I mean, and it takes sometimes a lot of work to get there, and that's, you know, part of the frustration of it. Believe me, I've had plenty of ideas that went just nowhere. I've got folders of ideas of, you know, things that just never, you know, I thought they seemed really promising, and then they just, you know, they just sort of died in the on the first page.
Those are definitely good ideas for people. Whenever people tell me, oh, I don't know what to write about, you know, there are 8 billion news stories out there. There are, you know, you pick up any kind of book, any kind of article, and you have the potential to say, wow, that's really interesting. I wonder what would happen if, or, you know, if you are reading enough, something is going to be tripped up in your head. And I also love the idea that, as I'm working on my young adult novel now, you write and kind of stop where you know you're going to pick up the next day, and then you can just kind of slide back into where you were.
Yes, and that's I think that's some advice Hemingway gave in his Paris Review interview that I'm always stuck with me, and probably thousands of others. And it does mostly work. Donald Bartlemy told me, I'm sure he told others, you know, write about what you fear most. And that was, you know, the sort of inspiration, if you will, behind the first and only novel I published. Because, you know, what does any father fear most is any harm coming to a child. So it's really about, that's the, sort of the subject of the novel. The other thing is, you know, you hear this sort of commonly, write about what you know, and that gets criticized a lot. But I think when I hear people object to that, well, that just means write about yourself or your own personal experience. It's really, that's not the case, because what you can imagine is what you know. That's a form of knowledge. And I love to use the example of Shakespeare. You know, he couldn't have possibly written these plays because he was, you know, he had the fifth grade education, you know, whatever. Well, the kind of education he had, you know, he would have been smarter in Latin and rhetoric than a Harvard graduate today. The other thing is, he went to London and surrounded himself by intelligent people. I'm sure, you know, this is the idea. This is not original with me. It's a wonderful book about this controversy about who wrote his plays, whose title I can't recall right now. But and so he surrounds himself with ambitious, smart, intelligent people. You know, he's borrowing books. He's hearing stories of their travels. And it really underestimates the power of the imagination. So because he didn't go to, you know, Venice, he couldn't possibly have written a play about that city. I think that's just absurd. It completely underestimates the power of the imagination. So when I ask my students to write about what they know, I emphasize that, you know, write about what you heard, write about what you, you know, things you've read, things you, you know, imagined, dreamt, whatever. And, you know, from all that range of things, you know, you're not writing about yourself. And I don't really write autobiographical fiction, although that is very much the trend now. Many writers are saying that they feel like that the conventions of realistic or realist fiction are feel so false to them that they feel like that now that they have to write autobiographical fiction. And I imagine in some cases it works, in others it may not. I'm not familiar with a lot of these writers, but that, I've noticed that trend in the last few years. And of course, memoirs are do better than fiction, and I have no idea why. But that's, again, another trend. On a slightly less happy note, I recently read a book about the publishing world, and one of the most powerful agents, Lynn Nesbitt, said, you know, if literary fiction is not dying, if it's not dead already, it is dying. And that was a, you know, pretty grim prognostication. But then again, she said, you know, the memoirs are what are selling, even if they are made up, you know, like, well, the famous cases of yes, go ahead.
Well, yeah, no, I love that you're a Stratfordian, by the way, as am I. But also, what is it? These terms always, I always wonder about them. What do you think it means to be literary? What do you think makes a literary novel or a short story collection literary?
I just suppose as a genre in general, and as a, you know, publishing genre, I guess in literary fiction, the expectations of the you know, the quality of the use of language is much higher, and that's fine. I mean, when people read other genres, they don't, you know, especially, I mean, my goodness, Dan, you know, people who read Dan Brown don't expect and don't care. And, you know, he's been called the worst, most successful writer in history. So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, that works. But I guess because my training, my early interest was in, you know, I guess like all, most all fiction writers, I'm a failed poet.
I'm just torn because to a great extent I totally agree with you. The only book I kind of go negative on my site is Twilight. And if you open up the book randomly to any page, you'll just cry because the writing is so bad. But you know, people buy it. But on the other hand, I don't have much of a problem with people reading, you know, Harry Potter or a ton of other stuff that is, it's really, really fun. And how do you classify literary and I guess just commercial fiction? Like T.C. Boyle, I find to be very, you know, I love him and his stories are great and his language is beautiful, but I can also see anybody picking up one of his books and enjoying them. So I always wonder what people mean when they say literary, not in a bad way, just what is that line and what does it mean?
Well, I think it's becoming harder to define. I mean, there are lots of writers out there who are, you know, mixing up genres and doing, you know, speculative fiction. I mean, a writer that I've been has been recommended to me, who just recently published The Bone Clocks, Jim Mitchell, apparently is doing this quite well. And so it's, you know, it's, what do you call his fiction? I mean, it's hugely popular, it's literary, it's brilliant, by all reports. And so I don't know, I guess the old categories are sort of breaking down. And I guess you could say, you know, it's insane. Art is hard to define, but you know it when you see it. So it's just really, I guess, probably more of a question about just good writing as opposed to mediocre writing.
Oh, definitely.
But, and publishing industry, literary fiction as a, you know, it is, I guess, selling less and less. And
Well, speaking of bookstores, I always think of Ray Bradbury and where do you put him? Because, you know, his writing is beautiful and amazing and powerful. Do you put him in the literary? Do you put him in science fiction, which would also be fair? And that leads me to the subject of bookstores. We're writers, we're people of the written word. What are some of the bookstores that you love the most?
Well, in town there is the Book Lady, and she hosts readings and signings, and it's an independent used bookstore. They sell new books as well, and that's my favorite bookstore in town. Of course, we have the Barnes and Noble at the mall. In New York, 192 Books is really there's something old school about their standards they just want the absolute best sort of writing out there. And I don't know if you've ever been, but if you're in New York, you should stop by there.
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't been to that one. I've been to the Strand. I've been to a bunch of other bookstores in New York. And I agree. I have my own ideas, but what is the reason that we need to continue to have independent bookstores?
Well, I think I can't rehearse this argument against what Amazon is doing to the publishing industry, but I guess the danger is between Amazon and these Barnes and Noble. There's matters is what sells the most, and that would tend to sort of weed out, I guess, writers. Maybe if you don't sell X number of hundreds of thousands of copies, or a writer I know, his first novels sold 20,000 or 30,000 copies, which a generation or two ago would have been like, okay, but you get a 3 or 4 book deal. And, you would work with the publisher, and that would be, you would have sort of your career with this publisher. And then they dropped it because that wasn't enough. But as first novels go, that was really pretty good. So, again, I don't understand exactly how all this is going to play out. Of course, no one does. But I think independent bookstores are great because you find stuff in there that you just wouldn't find anywhere else, whether they're old, used books, and they tend to be more eclectic and a bit more eccentric in their taste than something like a Barnes and Noble.
That's one of the things that I find really valuable too. The other day I got a book from 1961 about gambling, and it's written in this beautifully kind of Goodfellas-y prose about how you take the vig and how the bets are made and how you can win at roulette. It's just this really cool book that I would not have found otherwise.
And you found that in a used bookstore?
Right. And you pay a lot less. You pay a really low price and no shipping. It's just you do experience things that you wouldn't otherwise experience. You can give a chance to something for $3.99 as opposed to an $18 trade paperback. Definitely.
Another thing I might recommend for people who live in cities like Houston, every year, or they used to, but they may not still, the library would have a huge book sale at the Civic Center. And if you went there the first couple of days, you could get, I remember walking out of there with boxes and boxes of, books that were not even, they didn't have call numbers written on them. And, they just have to clear out their inventory to make room for more books. And that's, for people who love books, that is a great way to get books for nothing. And then the last few days, you could go in there with a grocery bag and they would charge you by the, $5 a bag, and you would just fit in there anything you thought would be interesting.
No, I love doing that. It's such a good feeling. You pick up, it's so cool. I've done that on several occasions where I get, a big stack of virtually free books. And, you know, you get some awesome stuff. Joyce Carol Oates I got the other day. You know, like, these are things that we need to preserve.
Yes. I read, digitally. My brother gave me a Kindle, and, you know, I have a lot of stuff on there that you can get through Gutenberg.org for nothing. A writer was in town, a humorist, and he was giving a talk to a class that I was visiting. And someone asked him about, what do you think about digital books? And he says, well, if anyone ever shows me my book is on their Kindle, I'll be happy to sign the screen for them. Which I thought was hilarious. In other words, he didn't like them at all. And I don't know. They're here, and I don't think they're going to replace the physical book. I just don't think. They thought digital recording would just get rid of analog and albums. And albums, I'm not a great music person, but I understand albums have made a bit of a comeback.
I love the Nook. I have a Nook because I don't want to do the Amazon thing at this point. But they I'm a baseball guy, and I love reading books about the steroid era, baseball history, and they're books that I might not necessarily need to have in paperback or hardcover. I don't want to make notes in them as much. So I love that I have all these books in one central place. But when I read, The Valley of Happiness by George Williams, I want to hold it. I want to write in the margins. I want to have a closer relationship with the book.
Yes, there is something, I don't know, it's an experience that I just don't get digitally. And I think it's irreplaceable. I mean, to immerse yourself in a book for 3 or 4 hours at a time, is unlike any other experience, and it's fairly new in terms of mystery storytelling, and I just don't think it will go away, because there's nothing to replace it. Films are one thing, but to me they're sort of like waking dreams. I've left movie theaters, and I'm halfway to my car, and I think, what did I just see? It's sort of, you wake up in the morning, you can't remember a dream you had. So, I just think there's just no other experience like that in what I guess they call it immersive reading, or they have new words for it now. And they're encouraging people to do that, to spend hours immersing themselves in a book they like, as opposed to, maniacally clicking from website to website on your computer, or reading a digital book on a Nook or a Kindle. So I'm optimistic that, the printed books will be here. And, some publishers, university perhaps, they produce beautiful books, just physical objects. As physical objects, they're great to have around.
It's definitely a fun debate. I want to kind of finish up with some questions that writers don't often ask each other, but they're really important and really cool questions. So first of all, how do you usually compose your first drafts? Me, I like to use my fountain pen, on a notebook, and kind of work from there. What's your general procedure?
Well, now that I've talked about that sounds sort of anti. I used to write on typewriter, and being left-handed, this is not true of every left-hander, but my handwriting is not the greatest. So I went from a typewriter to a computer, and so I do first drafts on the computer. I haven't written, longhand in decades, but. Yeah. I'm not alone in that. I imagine most writers now write on computers. Although I've heard that some say that they, absolutely have to do a first draft by hand.
I think it's a matter of just the way that you're experiencing the words, and they're all equally valid tactics. But I think that using a typewriter or a fountain pen it makes you think about the words more because it takes longer to put them down, and you're also using physical means to create the words on the page. But there's nothing inherently wrong. It's just a difference in technique.
Yes, I understand. Colin McCarthy, has written all his novels on the same typewriter. I forgot the brand name. And then I heard somewhere, and I found this hard to believe because he was such a famous sort of recluse, that he was living in Santa Fe, and you could go to the Santa Fe Institute, I believe it's called, and you can watch him write. So it was totally demystify this process. And one of the best things I ever said about writing was Tom Wolfe came down here 10 years ago to promote I Am Charlotte Simmons, and he gave a talk of packed auditorium. And, you know, a student sort of said, "Can I make a documentary about your life?" And he said, no. "The writer's life is, you know, it's just boring." He says, a writer is someone who sits alone in a room looking stupid, and that just cracked the audience up. And I think that's true. I mean, you know, he said he would sit there for months on end, just how do I write this novel? And just staring stupidly off into space. And then he put on this great expression of, you know, looking like an idiot, trying to figure out what to do with this book.
I love that. I'm a big fan of Harlan Ellison, again, literary or science fiction or fantasy. It's hard to classify, but he would do these he would call them stories under glass, where he would go to a bookstore window, sit there with a typewriter.
I've heard about this. Go ahead.
Yeah, and he'd come in. Someone would come in with a sealed envelope and say, "Okay, Mr. Ellison, we want a story about a zombie who eats oranges." And he'd say, "Okay," crack his knuckles, and then just go chicka chicka chick until he had a story. I like the idea of demystifying what writers do, but there is also that kind of mysterious, shadow life that we lead, where we sit alone in a room and think about ways to do crazy things or think about a world that doesn't exist. Very cool.
Yes, a poet I was lucky enough to know and work with. I didn't take workshops with him, but he taught graduate courses and had this wonderful eclectic reading list. Adam Zagajewski, I guess he's now in Chicago, but he's someone in a workshop or a class or a seminar. I asked him, you know, "What do you make of this gift?" He says, "I don't know when it will arrive. I don't know when or why it departs or why it goes away." He says, "You just have to wait." And it's also the question about, the difference between waiting and procrastinating. But I'm going off on a bit of a tangent there.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's the whole point. I am curious, once you have that first draft, how do you generally approach revision?
Well, I print out a hard copy. I'll often sort of put it aside for a while, and once I think I've finished more or less, a reasonably good draft, and then I'll just put it aside and work on something else and print out the copy and go back to it cold and, just do a line edit and just keep doing that over and over and over again. And I know in this computer digital world, we're supposed to be saving paper, but I go through a lot of paper that way, because I feel like I have to print out not just a page of something, but the entire thing and go over from beginning to end. Now I'm talking about, I do that with novels as well, but it's a slightly longer process.
Oh, sure. And it is really important to see the words on the page as opposed to just flickering lights on a screen.
Yes. I mentioned that to someone here who has a memoir coming out. And he said, no, I edit everything online. And I said, to me, it plays tricks on your eyes. I mean, there are always mistakes in one's writing, but I think they're easier to catch in a hard copy, at least for me. But I was surprised. I was reading a book by the historian Nell Painter, and it's this wonderful paragraph. And so I sat down to type it up. And in the process of typing it up, I discovered there were six just basic punctuation errors in this one paragraph that I didn't even notice when I was reading it. It was really strange. And I thought, where are the proofreaders at these publishing houses? You know, she's published on a major house, you know. And I don't know. I mean, I don't notice that necessarily in every book, but I wonder if it has to do with the digitizing of all of these, you know, people are just editing online. They're just not catching these mistakes that become obvious when you look at the hard copy or, you know, type it up in that case.
Yeah, I was reading a book by an author I love like crazy, and a lot of the brand names weren't capitalized, and I didn't know if that was an artistic choice or just a mistake.
Maybe some sort of ironic commentary on brand names. I have no idea.
The point is, though, I'm guessing the author didn't want me to think about whether or not they were making an ironic commentary on brands in the, you know, in contemporary America. You know, they wanted me to enjoy the story, but instead I was saying, well, gosh, I'm pretty sure Kmart starts with a capital K and then a hyphen, and then, you know, instead I got derailed. It takes me out.
Yeah, I was criticized online for misspelling Bennigan's in a novel. You know, I felt I don't care. I mean, I should care, but in that case, who cares about Bennigan's? You know, so what? I misspell it. But if I could go back and change it, I'm sure I would. The absolute best book that I've ever read about the deal that uses brand names is Donegal's White Noise.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'll end a chapter with one word, Panasonic, and it suddenly has this, you know, this wonderful reverberation. And, but, yeah, that's curious. I'm curious why they would do that.
Oh, definitely. We all have our guilty pleasures. We all have things that we don't want to admit that we're into. What's one of your narrative guilty pleasures? Reality TV, lower class documentaries? What are you into?
Gosh, I used to like to read, murder mysteries, and I guess there were some ghost writers, ghost story writers a while back. But I guess it's because I have, I'm aware I have limited hours to spend reading. So, I mean, I even canceled a half dozen, you know, book review, you know, like New York Review of Books and The New Yorker. Someone recently gave that to me as a gift. I'm glad to have it. And I just said, I'm going to do nothing but read books. So there's so many books I feel like I need to get to, and not necessarily ones that are current. And also going back and rereading, last year or two, went back and reread the new translations of Dostoevsky. And, you discover these really strange things that you either didn't notice or had forgotten if you read it 20 years earlier. Like, you know, those great novels are written in the first person. Strictly speaking, you know, you'll be reading and all of a sudden it'll say, I was told. And it's like, who is this I? You never know who they. So it reads like third person, but actually it's written in the first person. So, but I guess my tolerance, I just start reading a genre. You know, I keep hearing about this writer's a really great, you know, crime writer. This, and I'll go to the library, I'll check it out, I just find myself just line editing it, and you know that's unfortunate because it's meant to be. You know, the story's meant there to be, read and enjoyed, and it's just. I'm unable to sort of get into that sort of waking dream state with some of those. Because yeah. It's that compulsion to edit.
For me, I always advise people to have a balance, because a lot of young people and you know newer writers, they have a smaller frame of reference. They've only read Harry Potter, or maybe they heard most of To Kill a Mockingbird's plot in class when they were supposed to read it, so they don't have a wide range. So I beg them, please don't die having seen Citizen Kane, or not having seen Citizen Kane, but having seen Honey Boo Boo. You know, we are going to die at some point. We have to mix in some good stuff. You can watch Saw 8, but go ahead and read some T.C. Boyle, too. You know, like, you got to have a balance there.
No, I mean, it comes to film. My goodness, my daughter was recently visiting. We go on these horror movie binges over the holidays, and because I'm the only one who will watch them with her. And, you know, some of them are really deliberately awful and campy. But some of them are really remarkably good, and most recently this Babadook horror picture, which was a superb movie. It wasn't just a horror picture, and I don't want to spoiler alert, but you know, in the end, you're able to think about it the way you think about The Turn of the Screw. You know, very ambiguous ending. Which is so rare in that genre, but you know, even the bad ones can be amusing. So, but then again, you watch something like Tree of Life, and it sort of erases the memory of every movie ever made. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie.
Oh, I'm familiar with it, but yeah, no, there are some movies where you just sit back and you say, I cannot believe how good this movie is and how. I felt that way with The Lives of Others, the German film from a few years ago. You're just blown away at how beautiful the story is. And
oh yes, about the East German secret police. And
the Stasi. Yeah, you just get blown away by the beauty, and I got that with Blue is the Warmest Color recently, where it's 3 hours long, but it's a beautiful story about young love and how the world corrupts young love. And I was not expecting to be put in awe of the beauty of this film, but my goodness, you just feel excited and happy because, you know, an artist made a big connection with you.
Right.
Who are some of the primary mentors in your writing? To whom would you like to give some shout-outs?
Well, I guess, I'm working with... Donald Justice, the University of Florida first, and then Paget Powell, who sent me out to U of H to work with Donald Barthelme. And I really had a lot of superb writing teachers, and not just writing teachers, but also, literary, scholars and whatnot along the way. One writer that I really admire, the contemporary short story writer, Joy Williams, she's only published 3 collections, and her most recent one is Honored Guest. It is frightening. It is so good.
Oh, definitely.
I don't think there's anybody out there who writes as good of stories as she does. And, of course, I couldn't possibly do what she does. I mean, I'm sort of a fantasist. You know, I keep talking about literary fiction, but there's elements of the fantastic in my fiction that I just, can't help myself. Okay. I mean, and to do what she does, I mean, she just has an uncanny ear. I don't know if you're familiar with her. Her first book is called Taking Care. And then, anyway, I don't know if she'll, she's probably in her 60s. I think smart writers often just say, well, I've written what I need to write, and I'll go do something else.
I'm a little bit younger than that, so I can't imagine. But people can do whatever they like, and that's up to them. I do want to ask, because you made me think of it. When writers come to someone like you who has published books, who has a lot of success, What do you think, should young writers read a whole bunch of their teacher's work? I went into Ohio State having, like I said, oh, shoot, I better make sure I know all about Lee Martin, Lee K. Abbott, Aaron McGraw, Andrew Hudgens. I wanted to know about their work. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's a good approach. And I think that's the way it generally works, is that young writers tend to read contemporaries. Like, you know, when I was in my teens, you know, 15, 16, 17, you read things like Herman Hesse, well, who wasn't exactly a contemporary, but Vonnegut and stuff like that. And then as your interest expands, you start reading older stuff. And yes, I certainly read the writers that I worked with, because I wanted to know what they were doing. Because I could learn from their books as well as from, you know, their presence in the classroom or in the workshop.
And I suppose it doesn't hurt when a student comes into your class and says, "Oh, I loved your book. Would you mind signing it for me? Oh, when do grades come out again?" Right?
No, I don't get that. I mean, they don't they're not big book buyers. In fact, it's really, some of my students actually buy their the books I require for the workshops. They'll buy them digitally and they'll have them on their phone.
And
I'm like, I couldn't do that. Apparently they can do it. And so they're sitting there, you know, I'll ask them a question about a story, and they'll turn on their phone and go to their whatever they have on their Kindle, and they'll, you know, and I just couldn't do that. But I guess it's really just a question of it's just money. I mean, you know, it's just higher education, you know, college is just, the cost of college has gone up just, you know, absurdly, raised over the last 30 years. And, you know, it's, so they're really just trying to save the money.
I definitely see that point, and I kind of get it with respect to a $200 Bio 101 book. But I just don't get, you know, oh, I have to read Les Miserables and pay $5 for a used, you know, edition. I'll just get it on my phone and read a 500-page novel on my phone. No, you're not going to
Again, that immersive reading, if you're just laying on your couch or sitting in the chair reading this, I don't think I would ever feel like I was getting inside the story for very long. But again, this is simply because I'm older and more accustomed to books, and, you know, they're not, what are there slang terms for, you know, if they see something that's, you know, TMT, too much text, and that means if it's more than four paragraphs, it's like, all right, I'm done.
Yeah, the TLDR really depresses me.
What does that stand for?
The TL semicolon DR, too long, didn't read. So someone will say, look, I really believe in this political belief. Here's all my evidence. Here's this really well-structured argument. And then someone will just post TLDR.
Yes, I'll have to remember that one.
Yeah, you picture Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Someone just writes TLDR at the end of it. Like,
the theory of moral sentiments. Yeah. Just long didn't read. Maybe that might apply to the Gettysburg Address.
Oh yeah, I know, the 180 words or whatever it is. That, yeah, couldn't you cut it down a little bit there, Abe?
Yeah, it was one of the most, you know, precise and eloquent speeches in history. But some people think that this technology is literally on a physical way, in brain way, rewiring our brains. I don't know that, and the person who argues that is not a neuroscientist, but I think computers do change our reading habits online, where you know, when you read a book, you don't start off and then start flipping the pages faster and faster and faster and faster to the point where you're not really comprehending anything, but you tend to do that on the computer, and your attention span seems to get subdivided, you know, and subdivided and divided in half by half, you know, and then to the point where you realize you're not really paying attention to anything. You're not really absorbing anything.
Well,
it's good to, you know, read newspapers online in the morning before you get to work. But other than that, it can be, you know, kind of a
well, I definitely hope everybody out there picks up a copy of The Valley of Happiness in print from Raw Dog Screaming Press. They're a very cool press, by the way. They did Matt Betts' Odd Men Out, which is a great book, and they do a lot of cool stuff. I hope people pick it up and go to a quiet spot and just kind of work with the book. Most importantly, what should we look for next from you?
Well, I'm hoping another collection out from a press I won't mention, but there's no deal yet. And then I hope to, if the publisher of Raw Dog Screaming is willing, I'll have another collection with them sooner or later. And
very
after
cool.
that, I may have another collection somewhere. But again, I may reach that point where I say, well, I've done all, I don't want to just start repeating myself. So I don't know. It's hard to predict. But I hope to have 3 more books out in the not too distant future. That is, I hope.
Well, I hope people look out for those. George Williams, the author of The Valley of Happiness, Raw Dog Screaming Press, thank you so much for talking with me. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
No, thank you for your time and for the interest and interview.
All right, and thank you. Phew, that was a long conversation with a very cool writer. I really like that he's helped me kind of come to peace with my understanding of why people omit the quotation marks in dialogue. I really love the way that he advises us to use graphic art and use paintings for inspiration, but also as an accompaniment to our work. And most of all, I really love the way that he encourages us to experiment and to take our ideas to the next level. I hope you'll take a look at the link in the description of the video or the show notes on my website and get his book, that's The Valley of Happiness by George Williams from Raw Dog Screaming Press. That's all for now. This is Kenneth Nichols for Great Writers Steel. Remember, Shakespeare did it, so should you.